Welcome to All Sides with Anna Staver. When does a gun become a gun? That might sound like a philosophical question, but it's also a legal one. The U.S. Supreme Court will decide whether DIY gun kits should be regulated like guns, sold with serial numbers and background checks, or whether, legally speaking, those parts are not a gun, even if you can assemble one by drilling a few holes. They're called untraceable firearms, ghost guns, and they can turn up in crimes across Ohio and the country. The Dayton shooter in 2019 used a kit to convert his pistol, which is why we're spending the next hour all about ghost guns and what this case will mean. Justin Juvenile is a Supreme Court reporter for The Washington Post, and he's been covering this case, and he joins us now. Welcome to All Sides, Justin.
Thanks for having me on the show.
We're going to use some firearm lingo throughout this hour. So I want to begin by making sure all of our listeners are in the loop, because the Supreme Court justices are going to use these terms, so are the attorneys. Guns are made from different parts, and this case hinges on when those parts can be regulated like a gun. Two pieces that they talk about a lot are frames and receivers. Justin, can you explain what those are?
Yeah, frames and receivers are basically just the body of a gun that holds the barrel and the firing mechanism. So if you put your hand around a gun, that's basically the frame and the receiver.
And these parts are typically where guns would have a serial number, right?
Yeah. Most guns that are sold commercially, the manufacturer is required to put a serial number on the frame.
And they're also required to be licensed. And if they're sold at a retail establishment, you have to pass a background check.
That's correct. And also, there's an additional requirement, which is that the gun sellers themselves have to maintain records of the sale.
So complete frame and receivers, ones that are totally put together, are regulated by the Gun Control Act of 1968. But safe to say, a lot has changed since that law was written. And now you can buy kits where you drill a couple of holes and then you have a completed frame or receiver, right?
That's correct, yeah. And typically they're sold online.
And up until 2022, they were sold without those background checks, without those serial numbers.
Yeah, that's the correct. Over a decade ago, an industry arose where they would market these gun piece kits online to the industry says they're marketing to hobbyists who like to put things together, similar to the way people like to work on their cars on the weekends. And you can buy, a kit that has a number of different parts, including the frame, and it requires sometimes as little as 20 minutes to assemble the pieces into a fully working firearm.
Which brings us to Garland v. Vanderstock, which is the case before the U.S. Supreme Court now. And this hinges on whether these kits are guns, essentially what I said at the beginning. When is a gun a gun?
That's correct, yeah. That's the basically the central question at the heart of this case.
But interestingly, it's not about the Second Amendment, right? It's not about whether these can be sold. It's whether the law covers their regulation.
Yeah, that's correct. This is not a Second Amendment case about the right to bear arms. This case is solely looking at whether these ghost guns can be regulated under the 1968 Gun Control Act. So it doesn't implicate the Second Amendment in any way.
I got to ask the obvious question, but why doesn't Congress just pass a law dictating the regulation of these and clear up the ambiguity?
I mean, I think the political reality is that it would be difficult for Congress to pass a law on ghost guns at this particular moment, given the polarization in the country and firearms being a very hot button topic that divides Democrats and Republicans.
So we're stuck with the Gun Control Act of 1968, which defines both what is a gun and what is a frame or a receiver. We're going to get into all those thorny legal issues in this case with a law professor later in the hour. But I want to lay out the basic facts with you, Justin. One of the questions in this case is how easy these kits are to assemble. Here's Chief Justice John Roberts questioning the attorney for the gun rights groups.
What is the purpose of selling a receiver without the holes drilled in it?
Well, there some individuals, in just like some individuals enjoy like working on their car every weekend, some individuals want to construct their own firearm. So the purpose of selling it is to assist and provide individuals with material with which they can do that.
Well, I mean, drilling a hole or two, I would think, doesn't give the same sort of reward that you get from working on your car on the weekends.
Well, I would encourage the court to read the Vasquez brief. This is not a easy thing necessarily to do, and particularly the Press Democrat article cited there, where the reporter engaged to show how easy this was, and in fact show that he couldn't actually do it. He had to engage friends to help him complete this that were expert in the firearms. And even once you have a complete frame, it's not a trivial matter to put that together. There are small parts that have to be put in precise locations. And that reporter, he couldn't put it together from the completed frame. So it's not clear that it is clearly not a trivial proposition.
So that was Peter Patterson, the attorney for the gun groups. And he was saying these kits aren't as easy as they were being made out to be. But the government had a totally different take on this. Right, Justin?
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, the government's argument is that these kits are so easy to put together, they can be assembled in as little as 20 minutes, that, you know, they are essentially guns and they should be regulated as guns. And the Solicitor General Elizabeth Prelogar argued, that these kits were similar to, you know, buying a bike without the pedals or buying a tennis racket without the strings. Anyone who was purchasing one of these kits, you know, would know that they're basically a gun, and it only takes a couple of quick actions to assemble them into a working firearm. In fact, there's YouTube videos out there that show people just how to do those and what tools they need to do it.
Yeah, they were sold by companies like Polymer 80, which was once the country's largest producer of these kits and component parts, as 80% complete, that they were buy, build, shoot. Now, one of the things that comes up is companies like Polymer 80, which went out of business in August. A lot of these gun kit manufacturers say this law essentially put them out of business.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, they, you know, say that they can't, the market for their guns is dried up, and, you know, they feel like the regulation has been onerous and has sort of squashed their business.
That gets to the question of that comes up a lot is, what are these guns used for? Who is actually buying them?
Well, there's a difference between the sides on this one. The government originally regulated ghost guns in 2022 because law enforcement saw them showing up at an increasing number of crime scenes. So I believe in 2017, law enforcement submitted something like 1,700 ghost guns that they found at crime scenes for tracing. And that number exploded to about 19,000 by 2021. And according to Department of Justice statistics, they said that ghost guns were used in approximately 700 homicides and attempted homicides in 2021. So law enforcement became very concerned about people using and purchasing ghost guns for use in crimes. And also, they say that people who are prohibited from having firearms, such as felons and young people, are easily able to purchase them online, which sort of defeats the whole purpose of having gun control laws. On the other side, you know, the companies say, you know, we're marketing these to hobbyists. You know, this is something that some people enjoy putting together for fun, you know, as I said earlier, just like working on your car.
Yeah, and they also make the case that the vast majority of guns used in crimes come from the secondary market, not from these fabricators.
Right.
So that gets to one of the questions here in this case, and we talked about it before, there is a standard in that law of 1968 that says readily convertible. And there's a question about whether this applies to these kits, whether it applies to buying these frames or receivers, those bases of the guns. And the gun rights attorney, Peter Patterson, talked about this thing called critical machining, which doesn't appear in the law at all, but came up a lot in this court case.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the court case, a lot of the oral arguments last week were spent with the justices and the attorneys kind of grappling with, you know, what is readily convertible and how quickly do you have to be able to put a kit together for it to be qualify as readily convertible. You know, the government was saying, well, 20 minutes, you know, that's relatively quick. You can put together one of these kits very quickly. That's definitely readily convertible. You know, the gun owners and manufacturers and ghost gun companies were saying, well, some of these can take over 8 hours. So, you know, is that actually considered readily convertible? And then the justices got into a number of kind of interesting analogies. At one point, Justice Alito held up a pen and paper and he said, could this be considered a grocery list? You know, and then at another point, a question came up and he asserted, you know, if you had green pepper, onions, ham, and eggs, would that be considered a Western omelet? You know, so there was sort of a philosophical and sort of technical legal edge to the questioning going on over this readily convertible standard.
Yeah, the lower courts actually ruled against the government. And one of the reasons given was concern about how expansive these rules might actually be. Here's a clip of Justice Amy Coney Barrett asking the government's attorney, Elizabeth, for clarification on this.
A question about AR-15s. So Judge Oldham expressed concern that because AR-15 receivers can be readily converted into machine gun receivers, that this regulation on its face turns everyone who lawfully owns an AR-15 into a criminal.
That is wrong. So I want to be really clear about our interpretation of the statute. We are not suggesting that a statutory reference to one thing includes all other separate and distinct things that might be readily converted into the thing that's listed in the statute itself. So the example we give in our reply brief is that a pair of pants is not regulated as a pair of shorts if you have a statute referring to shorts, even though the pants could be readily converted into shorts. That's because pants are a distinct object in their own right and they have a separate identity.
I love that. They have such like fun analogies at the U.S. Supreme Court, but it is that idea that pants have a separate function, just like an AR-15. So therefore, all pants are not shorts.
That's correct. Yeah. They got into a bunch of these analogies, and a lot of them had to do with food because the hearing was coming up against the lunch hour.
So what are your sources saying? Do you have a sense of how they think the court might rule in this case?
Yeah, I mean, we want to be careful. It's difficult to say on these cases, and opinions can change after oral arguments. But my sense, reading the room during the oral arguments, is that the Supreme Court seems at least receptive to the government's argument that these regulations on ghost guns should be upheld. I definitely counted enough votes there to uphold the regulations as they stand.
Do we have any sense of when the ruling might come down?
Yeah, it should come down before the end of the term. The term typically ends at the end of June.
So we could be waiting. We'll probably be waiting until the spring to hear how they decided on this.
Yes, most likely.
What are you hearing from gun rights groups, from gun control groups? What are they really saying is at stake here for them?
Well, I think it's a huge case. I mean, this is a major gun regulation regulating a whole class of guns. You know, gun control advocates say ghost guns are basically have been crafted, designed as an end run around gun regulations. And if you allow them to be sold on the market without serial numbers, without background checks, you'll basically be allowing guns to be put in the hands of people who are barred from having them, people who have committed crimes, people who are too young currently to purchase firearms, and that is a real huge public safety risk. Gun advocates say, hobbyists enjoy putting these guns together, and these are not actually guns under the definition of the law. And for many years, the government itself, did not classify these parts as guns. So they feel like the government position, the government take on whether these ghost guns are actually guns has sort of evolved in recent years, and is really been a sea change.
It's kind of like the bump stock ruling. And I think, and feel free to correct me if I'm wrong, that it wasn't a question of whether the government could ban bump stocks, but whether the law allowed them to, as written.
Yeah, that's correct.
I guess then we will have to wait and see. That was Justin Juvenal, Supreme Court reporter for The Washington Post. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, a law professor breaks down the legal issues in this ghost gun case. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Ghost guns are firearms without serial numbers, untraceable by law enforcement, and up until recently, kits to make one were legal to buy online without a background check. Manufacturers like Polymer 80 sold assemble-yourself gun kits, but then the federal government updated its definition of a firearm to include these kinds of DIY kits, putting companies like Polymer 80 and others out of business. Gun rights groups got together with manufacturers and some owners and sued. So now the U.S. Supreme Court will decide when a gun legally becomes a gun. Here to help us wade through the legalese in this case is Ohio State Law Professor Bridget Dooling. She's a nationally recognized expert on administrative law and regulatory policy. Professor Dooling, welcome to All Sides.
Good morning, Anna. So glad to be here.
This case revolves around whether the ATF has the authority to update that definition of a firearm, not whether Congress could regulate these ghost guns, right?
Yep, that's right.
And so it's similar in that sense to the bump stock case the court decided last term.
Yes, bump stocks, both bump stocks and the ghost guns cases are what we would call statutory cases as opposed to constitutional cases, which really do a Second Amendment type analysis.
So basically, this is about what an agency like the ATF can do before it needs approval from Congress.
Yeah, you basically go back to the statute that Congress wrote, in this case, 1968, and see, what are the parameters, what are the, boundaries of what Congress wants ATF to do.
Fair to say a lot has changed in terms of gun manufacturing between 1968 and now.
No kidding. And agencies often find themselves in this scenario, as Congress has done less reauthorizing of existing legislation. You often find agencies dealing with statutes, written in the 60s, 70s, 80s, trying to use those for the problems of today.
So one topic the justices kept coming back to in oral arguments was when the parts for something legally should be regulated as that thing. Here's an exchange between Justice Samuel Alito and U.S. Solicitor General Elizabeth Prelogar.
Here's a blank pad and here's a pen, all right? Is this a grocery list?
I don't think that that's a grocery list, but the reason for that is because there are a lot of things you could use those products for to create something other than a grocery list.
All right,
and so it's not like they're...
If I show you, I put out on a counter some eggs, some chopped up ham, some chopped up pepper and onions. Is that a Western omelet?
No, because again, those items have well-known other uses to become something other than an omelet. The key difference here is that these weapon parts kits are designed and intended to be used as instruments of combat, and they have no other conceivable use.
So it's a definitely Western omelets, grocery lists. Mm-hmm. We got a lot of fun analogies in this case.
Yeah, we sure did. And I love that exchange because it really shows off the skill of our Solicitor General, Elizabeth Preloger. She's just amazing on her feet and just sort of takes the hypo and is able to, you know, analyze it on the fly.
Yeah. Then Justice Amy Coney Barrett followed up in an interesting way, almost like she was giving Preloger a little bit of an assist.
General Preloger, I just want to follow up on Justice Alito's question about the omelet. Would your answer change if you ordered it from HelloFresh and you got a kit and it was like turkey chili, but all of the ingredients are in the kit?
Yes, and I think that presses on the more apt analogy here, which is that we are not suggesting that scattered components that might have some entirely separate and distinct function could be aggregated and called a weapon in the absence of this kind of evidence that is their intended purpose and function. But if you bought, you know, from Trader Joe's some omelet-making kit that had all of the ingredients to make the omelet and maybe included whatever you would need to start the fire in order to cook the omelet and had all of that objective indication that that's what's being marketed and sold, we would recognize that for what it is. And it doesn't stretch plain English to say, I bought omelets at the store if you bought all of the ingredients that were intended and designed to make them.
So that was Preloger basically saying these gun kits are like meal delivery kits. They're not like ingredients in your refrigerator.
Yeah, and you gotta appreciate it. The justices are just like us, right? They shop at Trader Joe's, they put together IKEA furniture, they deal with meal delivery kits. Yeah, it really helps you get a sense of how they're trying to find the line in this case for when a gun becomes gun.
And it is a little bit of an esoteric exercise, a philosophical question, but it has real world impacts because how we define these kits will determine how they're sold.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, just to give your readers a little perspective on like what type of legal question we're trying to answer here, it's one of statutory interpretation. And if you'll indulge me, I'll just ask you, do you think fish are tangible objects?
Yeah. I mean, like a physical fish in front of me. Yeah.
Yeah, sounds right, right? Well, apparently no, under the law.
What?
There's a statute that determines what may be destroyed in the context of a federal investigation. And because of the way that term was written into the law, the Supreme Court held that a fish is not a tangible object for purposes of that statute, right? Let me give you another one give me another second.
Sure.
What about bees? Do you think bees are fish?
Bees are absolutely not fish.
Okay, well, at least in California, they are, because there's
the
California Endangered Species Law lists invertebrate in the definition of a fish. And since bees are invertebrate, they're fish under the California law. So I raise these as for two reasons. One, this is why people roll their eyes at lawyers all the time, and we're used to it. Two, these are also exactly the kinds of questions that courts have to look at all the time, drawing lines about what words do and don't mean. And so that's how we find ourselves in this position, trying to figure out when a gun becomes a gun for purposes of the Gun Control Act.
Yeah, because you have to draw the line somewhere. And then that gets really complicated and sticky when you think about it. I guess that's how bees become fish.
That's right.
Yeah, I've seen those cases, too, about what is a sandwich.
Yes.
Whether a taco is a sandwich. And there's a lot of debate. And there was a whole lawsuit over a taco shop that wanted to open in a certain place. But it had to be a sandwich shop and whether that was a sandwich. And I was like, oh, my goodness.
Exactly. There was just that Ohio case, too, about whether a
boneless
wing. Yeah, you got it. Yeah, exactly. So that was a case in tort, actually, not in statutory interpretation. But we do have a good time with the law.
Yeah. The court spent a lot of time talking about the phrase readily convertible. Why is that phrase so important to this case?
Yeah, it's really important because that's the language of the Gun Control Act. The Gun Control Act, on its own terms, right there in the statute, applies to, you know, essentially finished firearms. But then they also have another provision that describes weapons which can be readily converted to basically function like a firearm. So in the statute itself, Congress was anticipating the possibility of a product that was not quite a firearm, you know, still being right on the doorstep of being a firearm and therefore something that they wanted to regulate under this law.
And that's where those complete kit comes in. But then there was this other question about the incomplete frames of a handgun or a the incomplete, yeah, frame of a handgun or a receiver in a rifle. So these two, like, it's the part that you hold, the part with the trigger. They're just called different things depending on the kind of gun. And Peter Patterson, the attorney for the gun rights groups, had a lot to say about the fact that readily convertible wasn't in the statute when they were talking about frames and receivers. So what do you make of his idea that, like, readily convertible is in subsection A, frames and receivers are in B, and therefore it's not supposed to apply?
Yeah, I mean, what matters less is what I think and more how the justices handled it on the fly,
yes.
Right, which was to sort of bat that aside. And so I think the way you see when you listen to the oral argument, you sort of see the justices coming around and pretty comfortable, it looked to me, with the idea that, you know, a kit is essentially readily converted.
Yeah, he talked about this idea. He suggested a critical machining test. Here's a cut of him, of Peter Patterson, making that case to the Supreme Court.
There definitely has been a sea change by the agency here. The agency projected that its rule would put 42 out of 43 unlicensed manufacturers out of business. And what the agency said in the Syracuse litigation was, they said, an unfinished frame or receiver does not meet the statutory definition of firearm simply because it can be designed to or can readily be converted into a frame or receiver. That's the exact standard they've now adopted. Instead, what they looked at was whether critical machining operations had taken place. And to be clear, we have no quarrel with that prior practice. We have raised as alternatives, one, something has to be completely machined, or two, the critical machining operation test. And the latter, we submit, is more consistent with the statutory language.
So there's a lot of legalese going on there, but essentially he is arguing that if you have to drill a couple holes into one of these kits, then critical machining has not been done.
Right. Yeah. So this is all trying to draw the lines, right? How far along in the process of being built does a firearm have to be in order for it to, you know, trigger this statute?
How many special tools do you need?
Yeah. How much time? How much expertise, right? I mean, do you have to be quite skilled at this, maybe even do it as
maybe
part
you're
of
a mechanic.
Profession. You're a mechanic, exactly. You've got, you know, advanced skills that you wouldn't expect, you know, the regular public to have. So they're more comfortable with that standard because it allows it requires a much higher amount of expertise and skill in order to build the kit, which obviously benefits them.
Yeah, there was a lot of conversation about jigs. So there's, like, I learned so much about how guns are manufactured while just from listening to oral arguments. But these kits sometimes would come with a dimple, like an X drill here. But then they started making kits without that dimple, but they'd send you this little tool that you put on top and it told you where to drill. And they were like, and the federal government says, oh no, that's readily convertible. And they're like, no, it's not.
Yeah. And that's why we're at the Supreme Court, is basically that in a nutshell, right? Whether, you know, it's not just a blueprint for a gun, right? It's the materials. And then it's also, you know, a very clear template for exactly what kind of hole to drill and where.
Justices don't decide these cases in a vacuum. They look at other cases, other legal precedents to guide them. They reference this Syracuse case, or at least both sides actually talked about it and how the government was interpreting readily convertible then. But I also want to ask you about a major case from last term called Loper-Bright that upended 50 years of administrative rulemaking. How does that case about deference to state agencies when they make a rule impact this case about guns?
Yeah, so Loper-Bright was this case that came down last summer, and it upended a long-standing rule of administrative law, which was that courts should defer to agencies when Congress didn't answer the question at issue and the agency's interpretation was reasonable. So in the lower court, with this case, with the Vanderstock case, the district court judge did not actually afford the agency deference. In his mind, the case was so close, and he would say that, you know, Congress didn't answer the question here, that basically the agency had gone too far. So at least in the trial court here, which was before, you know, the Supreme Court struck down so-called Chevron deference in the Loper-Bright case, there we had a judge that wouldn't have even applied Chevron deference had it still existed.
Yeah, and then it works at works its way all the way up. And I wonder, given that the court did end Chevron deference, if that gives us any clues to how they may come down in this case.
Yeah, I was listening for that. And honestly, I mean, I expected, if that was the case, I would expect the justices to have seemed a lot more skeptical of government regulation in this case. I think it's fair to say that we have a Supreme Court right now that comes to the bench with a fair bit of skepticism about the administrative state and thinking about how to constrain the regulatory authority of administrative agencies. But in this case, we've got a statute that talks about the idea of something readily being readily converted. And then, you know, we have some pretty interesting sort of factual contestation where some folks are saying, oh, no, this is really easy to do. And some folks are saying, no, you actually need to be pretty expert in this. All of that sort of rolls up to me to an oral argument that suggested that the justices were inclined to leave the DOJ rule in place.
They came to the opposite conclusion, though, in the bump stock case from a couple months ago, where they said, look, Congress can regulate these things and they convert semi-automatic weapons to they make it easier to fire as an automatic weapon, if I'm understanding them correctly.
Yep.
And so the U.S. Supreme Court said Congress can go ahead and regulate that. We weren't addressing that Second Amendment right issue, but they don't have the authority to do it right now.
Yeah, that's right. So similar to what we've been talking about, in that case, the court was basically looking at a statute and seeing whether the statute, you know, gave, again, ATF, in this case, the legal authority to regulate this product called bump stocks. And in that case, there was a majority for the idea that the statute, you know, did not extend to bump stocks. It was a highly technical argument, though, really grounded in how, like, the mechanism of how bump stocks work and whether that type of mechanism was contemplated in the statute. So, I mean, in that case, you're right. They did send the agency back to the drawing board. But it was also looking at a different part of the statute and a very different sort of factual situation.
Yeah, I sort of wonder in the post-Chevron deference world if we're just going to see a lot more of these kinds of cases.
Yes, I think we are absolutely going to. I mean, courts always have to deal with questions of statutory interpretation, like the issue of
Your whole career of study.
That it sure is, and it's a life's work. We are going to continue to see lots of these things, not just at the district court level, but also the appellate levels, and of course the Supreme Court, as the importance of statutory interpretation really comes to the fore because the court rolled back the Chevron deference standard.
I think it was Justice Ketanji Jackson Brown who raised this concern about whether this is all just going to come down to how the court defines these terms.
Yep, and she's right. She also raised, I think it was her that raised this idea of how to tell when something is a major question, right? Are we in a scenario where there's an argument that regulating ghost guns is such a sweeping question that we really need Congress to answer it. That type of reasoning is one that the courts used in other cases recently. And so she was, if I believe, sort of probing on that question. But it doesn't look like that is going to be the deciding factor in this case.
I also wonder, and this is a kind of a sideways question, about whether, you know, increasing, I don't know, inaction by Congress, inability to pass major legislation, creates more and more of these cases. I mean, we're talking about the Gun Rights Act of 1968.
Yep. And as you note, I mean, a lot has changed since 1968 in our society with respect to the technology available for firearms.
The internet and the ability to watch a YouTube tutorial on assembly.
Exactly. Yeah, it's all right there at your fingertips. And so, I mean, that notion of, you know, Congress sort of sitting back, being too passive and not answering these questions is part of what motivated at least some to overturn Chevron deference. The idea being, you know, Chevron deference allows for Congress to basically write these broad statutes for agencies and then hand them over to the agency to implement. Then it's the agency's problem, right, to sort of draw all these lines and thread all these needles. Meanwhile, Congress can sort of sit back and just criticize, right? So some would argue, although I'm not sure I'm totally on the same page with this argument, that, you know, repealing Chevron deference means that Congress will get back into the driver's seat and do more legislating. I'm a little bit on the fence about that because there's a lot of reasons why Congress doesn't legislate as often as we might want them to. Some of it's just limited capacity. They can't answer all the questions that need to be answered. But there's a lot of structural reasons why Congress does not legislate as much as we might like them to.
And they can't anticipate all circumstances. When the lawmakers of 1968 put readily convertible into that law, they didn't know how guns were going to change.
Yeah, that's right. And we come up against this all the time with administrative regulation because you're dealing with older statutes that were enacted for a particular context, for a particular purpose. And then society evolves, technology evolves, and you still got agencies trying to use these old standards to apply to new technology. It really is quite tricky. And you can have a difference of opinion about whether you should limit agencies to something pretty narrow, right? A narrow conception of what Congress was doing when they enacted a bill. Or you can kind of view that statutory language as sort of a functionally a blueprint for the agency to follow when thinking about new problems. And so you can have different views about what you want Congress to be doing, what you want the federal agencies to be doing. And a lot of that, that's the background of these cases. It's a lot of what's sort of the larger atmospheric context that doesn't come through when you just listen to an isolated oral argument on, you know, what counts as a gun.
Or what are shorts or pants.
Exactly.
That was Ohio State Law Professor Bridget Dooling. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, how ghost guns have impacted Ohio, and what law enforcement thinks about this case. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We're talking about ghost guns this hour. Guns made from DIY kits or 3D printed. Guns that don't have serial numbers you can trace back to a manufacturer or a point of sale. The U.S. Supreme Court is deciding whether these firearm kits, these ghost guns you build yourself, can be sold without background checks, serial numbers, licensed dealers. So far, we've learned about the case Garland v. Vanderstock. Now, we're going to focus on Ohio, how ghost guns have been used here at home. Brian Steele is the president of the Fraternal Order of Police, Capital City Lodge No. 9. And he joins us now. Brian, welcome back to All Sides.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
I want to begin with the legality of ghost guns in Ohio. Under the current law, can a hobbyist build their own firearm?
Yes.
Can they sell it?
No.
And they can't transfer it without a serial number, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And felons, people under 18, they're still just prohibited from having these kinds of guns.
That is correct.
So the government's attorney, Elizabeth Prulager, told the court that the hobbyist market for these kits never really materialized. Here's a cut of her from oral arguments.
I want to begin with the question you asked about why manufacturers would leave these holes undrilled. You said, what is the purpose? My friend responded that it's to create a kit that hobbyists can put together. I think that that's a questionable proposition, given that if it only takes 20 minutes, the hobbyist is probably not going to get his money's worth and won't actually have the experience of building a gun. But I also think it's contradicted by the facts on the ground, because what the evidence shows is that these guns were being purchased and used in crime. They were sold to be crime guns. There was a 1,000% increase between 2017 and 2021 in the number of these guns that were recovered as part of criminal investigations. And it makes perfect sense, because the whole reason why you would want to get your hands on one of these unserialized, untraceable firearms is if you are a prohibited person or you want to use that gun in a crime. And more fundamentally, if there is a market for these kits for hobbyists, they can be sold to hobbyists. You just have to comply with the requirements of the Gun Control Act.
So, Brian, what do you make of her claim that ghost guns, the people who are buying them, the large part of the market, were people who shouldn't have been accessing them.
So I have no evidence to speak in absolutes. I could tell you there are probably some individuals who do buy these for a hobby. There are some individuals that buy these for a crime, just like they use the term, they use them as weapons of combat. Some individuals are buying these because they're cheap and they're using to target shoot. As a law enforcement officer, we are concerned with the criminal element of it.
So let's talk a little bit about the criminal element. According to the ATF, the number of ghost guns or privately made guns that they've been requested to trace, meaning they were used in some kind of crime, jumped from about 1,600 in 2017 to nearly 20,000 in 2021. That's a pretty big jump.
It is. We're concerned that a weapon is used in a crime and does not have the ability to trace it. That is certainly a concern with the FOP and law enforcement here in Central Ohio as well.
So, but on the flip side, you know, Texas Senator Ted Cruz has slammed this rule from the ATF, saying that ghost guns represent a small percentage of the guns used in crime. That when you actually look at the numbers, so in 2021, Chicago saw a 92% increase in ghost gun seizures from 2019, but that was still only 2% of their gun crime cases.
So that's also true. I could speak here in Columbus in 2023, CPD recovered 43 ghost guns, and we touted, look at these 43 we removed from the street, which we don't want these guns on the street in illegal crime, but we removed that year 3,693 illegal guns, which I'm no mathematician, we should ask the professor, but it's a little over 1%.
Yeah, the attorney for the gun kit manufacturers, Peter Patterson. A tricky alliterative name. He said this during oral arguments.
And notably, Congress did not regulate the secondary market for firearms. And that secondary market is a much bigger source of firearms for criminals than privately made firearms.
So he's essentially making that argument that Congress doesn't regulate the secondary market, but that's probably where most guns for crimes come from.
Sure, absolutely.
So where do we go from here? I feel like this is, I mean, there's the esoteric question, right? When does a gun become a gun? But also, who is buying these? What types of controls should we have on them? Does the FOP, does law enforcement have a take on this?
So we do not concern ourselves with the Second Amendment. If someone wants to purchase a firearm for the rightful reasons,
wants to buy a hobby kit,
not a problem. We look at the crimes. We don't want them in the hands of juveniles. We don't want them in the hands of individuals or domestic violence abusers, registered felons. And what's the gun being used for? Unfortunately, here in Columbus, your violent crime of homicides, the overwhelming majority of homicides, the weapon used is a firearm. It's not a bump stock. It's not an AR. It's not all the things that nationally, you know, they really get our attention. More often than not, it's a handgun.
And these kits, I guess it would be silly to ask you whether you think they're easy to assemble or not. You probably have a lot of the technical skill that would be necessary to put it together.
Yeah, I could tell you I have zero technical skill. As a police officer, 20 years, my weapon is a tool, just like a carpenter is the hammer. I could not even tell you how to put one of these things together. I just understand they're cheap. You buy them in piecemeal. It's saving money, and it's going against you don't have to maybe go through the red tape, which is there for a reason, to regulate who gets them.
Yeah, they are made from polymers and composites, sort of low-end gun manufacturing pieces. They usually cost $300, $400. So not, I mean, that's still expensive, but when you're talking about guns that can get into the $800,000 range pretty quickly, they're on the low end of gun prices.
That's what it sounds like, pretty cheap.
Yeah, one of the questions I had, and this is sort of complicated, is the Dayton shooter in 2019 bought a modification kit for his pistol. And those are kind of, they're kind of at issue in this case, but they're also kind of not, about whether that kind of modification to a weapon that he bought unserialized off the internet, like how much regulation we should have over that.
Sure. So it's similar to the Glock switches. That's a problem we're definitely seeing now amongst the gang members in our city. They're buying these little devices, making their gun from semi-automatic to fully automatic. Illegal, by the way, and certainly something that we need to stop doing.
Yeah, it was one of the questions that came up during our arguments of whether, we played the clip earlier, Justice Amy Coney Barrett said, hey, is all AR-15s now considered illegal because you can buy this modification kit? And the government was like, no, because they're a completely separate object with a completely separate purpose.
It is hard. So one of the questions a citizen will say, hey, is this gun illegal? Well, you have to look at the ATF regulations change. Was a brace illegal? It was legal, then illegal, then illegal again. So you have to, as an officer, law enforcement officer, sometimes you just say, it depends. I have to look this up because it's constantly changing.
Yeah, there's questions about short-barreled rifles. At one point, is a pistol a short-barreled rifle? At what point should it be regulated as such?
Absolutely. And a lot of these things, people don't think you can buy a fully automatic weapon in Ohio. You just have to register it with the government. You have to get a tax stamp. You have to pay some money.
There's a lot
waiting
of hoops.
List. Yes.
And that's really what this case hinges on. How many hoops should you have to jump through to buy a kit?
Sure. So again, we do not want these guns getting in the wrong hands. If there's some mechanism to ensure that they're in lawful gun owners' hands, the FOP will never stand in the way with that. But we will do anything we can to stop them from getting in the wrong hands, used against our officers or the citizens of our city.
I think we hear the phrase ghost gun and it immediately sounds spooky.
Yeah.
The idea that it's untraceable, that it's got no serial number. How much harder does that actually make it to figure out where the gun came from?
It's very difficult, probably almost impossible, to find the point of origin, just like sometimes the serial numbers are also filed off at times. There are experts who could, you know, break that down, even though it's filed off, can still be able to tell where it came from. But we like to trace the gun back to the original manufacturer. But oftentimes the gun used in crimes might have been bought in California at a store, but it might have changed hands 10, 20 times and made its way to Ohio. They are very difficult. This just makes it even more difficult to track back.
Yeah, because even if you know where the parts came from, right, if the part is stamped with the gun manufacturer who sold the kit, they might sell hundreds, thousands of kits. You don't even know if that kit was sold to somebody in Ohio.
Very difficult, which is why, again, we oppose these getting in the wrong hands.
I know you said you don't take positions on what laws do or don't get created that often, but is it ever frustrating that we're arguing about a law from 1968 when the world has so fundamentally changed?
Sure. And again, I tell people as law enforcement officers, we enforce laws on the books. We don't get to pick and choose which laws. So it's up to our elected officials, whether it's the state house or it's in the halls of power in D.C., come up with the laws. But laws are only good if they are enforced. They're only good enforced if they're prosecuted. And they're only good prosecuted if a judge holds somebody accountable. So we always say enforce the laws on the books. Sometimes these problems correct themselves. If there was a law saying a ghost gun was an enhanced offense and say if you use it in a crime, it's now a felony, it's now 20 years in prison, and we hold you to that, these things will solve themselves overnight.
Speaking of that, has the regulation from ATF changed anything here in Ohio? There was a brief submitted to the court in this case from 20 major cities who said they had seen the number of ghost guns recovered in crimes decrease since this went into effect.
This was submitted. I don't have the 2022 numbers or the 2024 numbers. I was hoping to have them before I got here. I could tell you, I read those briefs. In those briefs, we talk about terrorism, extremists, defects, abusers, all the key words that raise our eyebrows. The reality in the city of Columbus, the illegal guns are impacting the most people of color. 9 out of 10 of our victims in the city of Columbus, vis-a-vis homicide by guns, are people of color. 75% of our suspects in gun violent homicides are people of color. We have to talk about root issues facing us, and it's not my opinion, it's ghost guns.
Yeah. It's so difficult. I mean, if we're going to talk about like the causes of gun violence in communities, it goes so much further than access to the firearms themselves.
100%. It's your culpable mental state where you knowingly do it recklessly, purposely, and let's find out why. When I listen to politicians talk, gun violence experts talk, activists talk, they never want to address that fact. Who is this gun violence impacting the most? Why aren't we having a bigger conversation about that and trying to solve that to keep people alive?
And when you talk, I'm sure when you talk to the sellers of guns and gun stores and firing ranges, they all come down on the same place. Like, if you've ever been in a gun range and you start waving a gun around, you're going to get lit up pretty quickly. And I don't mean literally lit up, like you're going to get escorted out.
Oh, 100%. And it's same with the Columbus Police Academy. We have basic firearm safety rules, and you do not go sideways from those. And if somebody does waves the gun around, points it the wrong direction, even in the police academy, you will be escorted out and you'll fail that class.
So it sounds like, if I'm understanding you correctly, the opinion of yourself, the FOP here, is that ghost guns are being used in crimes, but it's going to really just be up to the court to decide how they get regulated.
Yeah, and that's the great part of this question, and not to belabor, you talked about it. Can a regulation agency like the ATF come up with these rules, or should our legislators come up with these rules, or do you want our laws be enacted from the bench? And I love the professor. We could talk about this about almost anything. I think the point is our congressmen and senators are supposed to come up with these laws, but it seems like, you know, in the last 10, 20 years, that's kind of changed.
That was Brian Steele, president of the Fraternal Order of Police, Capital City Lodge No. 9. Thank you for your time, as always.
Thank you so much.
And thank you all for listening to All Sides, right here on 89.7 NPR News.